reading is Jeremiah 48, verses 10 to 13. Cursed is he who does the work of the Lord with slackness, and cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed. Moab has been at ease from his youth, and has settled on his lees. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, nor has he gone into exile. So his taste remains in him, and his scent is not changed. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I shall send to him tilters who will tilt him and empty his vessels and break his jar in pieces. And then Moab shall be ashamed of Chemosh, as the house of Israel was ashamed of Bethel, their confidence. Now, what do you make of all that? The meaning of all that, I suppose, is not immediately obvious. If we went back earlier in the book, we'd find that back in chapter 27, Moab was one of several nations that came to King Zedekiah with a proposal to form an alliance that could resist Babylon, that was in the process of gobbling up nations round about and was God's instrument to punish Judah. But Jeremiah said to Zedekiah, send these people back. Trust in the Lord. Don't hook up alliances with all these other nations, because they also are going to fall under God's judgment. The nations were Moab, Ammon, and Edom, who are all east of the Jordan in the area that today is the nation Jordan. The other two were Tyre and Sidon, which of course answer to Lebanon today. When you get into this part of Jeremiah, there are announcements of judgment on lots of nations, and those nations I just mentioned are included. And the one who is going to carry out this judgment is going to be Babylon. So Babylon is God's instrument, not only to punish Judah, but also to punish these other nations. And that's the reference in verse 10, to doing the Lord's work with slackness. It's not a reference to you and me, who might be a bit lazy in our service for the Lord. Maybe we do need to be reminded that we're a bit slack at times, but that's not what Jeremiah is talking about. Jeremiah is talking about Babylon doing God's work. That's why he said, so don't be slow, Babylon, to come and do what God has got you to do. The first half is explained in the second half of verse 10. Cursed is he who does the work of the Lord with slackness. Cursed is he who keeps back his sword from bloodshed. And so the Babylonians are going to go in there and punish Moab. Now, why is Moab going to be punished? Well, for various reasons that are outlined elsewhere. If you read the chapter through, you'll get a fuller insight. But I'm just going to concentrate on these few verses, because we have this very interesting picture of making wine. Now, I don't know a lot about making wine, but the way it's done apparently is that you have this vat full of wine and they leave it sit, and it sits for a long time, and slowly the sediment just settles on the bottom. That's called the lees, or the dregs if you wish. And after it's sat for so long, the liquid at the top becomes a bit clearer, the rubbish is on the bottom, so they then tip the fluid into another vat, throw the dregs away, and then leave it again. And so it slowly, but it settles a second time. And so it keeps on going, so that the wine itself becomes clearer and clearer, and the lees or the dregs or the sediment on the bottom gets thrown out. But if, of course, you don't tip it at the right time, the stuff on the bottom stagnates, it goes sour, and it will spoil the whole vat full of wine. Moab has been undisturbed. It hasn't had a lot of difficulty. It hasn't been tipped. Now, some of these other countries around have been tipped one way or another. The nation of Israel and Judah, it was tipped on its head well and truly. Half the nation was taken into captivity, and now the second half is on the verge of going into captivity. But Moab just sat there. And he said, the problem with you now is that because you haven't been tipped out, it's like wine that's been sitting there and it's gone sour. And so its taste is now no good. That's what he says in verse 11. Moab has been at ease from his youth, and so now he's settled on his lees, he's settled on the dregs. He hasn't been emptied from vessel to vessel. He hasn't gone into exile. And so his taste now has gone bad. And it's that taste of the dregs and the sediment on the bottom has now soured the whole lot. And so it's no use. So you may as well now throw it all out into verse 12. There are going to come people now who will tilt you well and truly and tip you up and get rid of the whole lot. That's going to be the end of Moab. And then you'll realize that this God in verse 13 that you trusted in won't be able to help you. You won't be able to trust in that God any longer. It will prove useless. So there is the meaning, I think, of that small section. It is telling us the danger, the penalty, the outcome, if you wish, of an easy life. You get it too easy, and so you go sour. And in the end, you're good for nothing, and so you must be thrown out. That is what God is saying to Moab. Now, as I mentioned, Israel and Judah had already had a fair amount of pasting from one enemy or another. The nation of Israel had, of course, been the northern part, had been taken off into captivity by the Assyrians. And now the southern part was about to be taken off into captivity by the Babylonians. There's a message for them in it too. But the message here is mainly for Moab. Ease leads to laziness. It leads to self-indulgence. It leads to complacency. And then we become unaware of our condition until something catastrophic happens. And then all of a sudden, you've got to wake up. I suppose this would be a good sermon to commemorate the first anniversary of September the 11th, where it was a wake-up call. And I'm not having a shot at America, because their problems are just the same as the rest of us. We sit around in all sorts of complacency, then disaster strikes, and somehow people are shaken. We're ignorant. In fact, sometimes we're still ignorant even after the event. I wonder how much George Bush actually has learnt, to be quite honest. He still seems to be saying, you know, but we're so good. Why does this happen to us? And I think to myself, man, aren't you ever going to wake up? How about seeing ourselves as others see us? Now look at our countries. Look at the Western world. Look at the self-indulgence, the waste, the greed. I mean, we're proud of it. We're going to have a horse race in a month or so's time. It'll be on the telly again. We gambled X number of million dollars on a horse race. As if you've got to be proud of it. And then you see of all these people in other countries that are dying of all sorts of diseases and so on, and here we are spending millions of dollars on cosmetic surgery, change some little bit of your face or some other part of your anatomy to make you look pretty. And you go to these people who can't even get worm medicine or aspirin, and here we are. Well, I could go on and on. You know all about this. This is the sort of complacency, and then something happens and people get a bit angry over this and other things as well. And, oh, it shouldn't happen to us. Like Moab, it sat there, settled on its lees, it turned sour, and it was totally irresponsive to anything. Persecution, difficulty, hardship, all of these things, they produce strength. And that's why the church is so strong in awful countries. Some of the countries that are clapped out economically and socially and politically, they're in chaos, and yet inside you seem to have a strong, vibrant church, because difficulty, hardship, produces character. We're told this in the Bible, of course, that hardships and trials and tribulations, they produce character and produces endurance, produces these good things. But when we're like we are, just sort of drifting along, it just finishes up with a feet sort of a church, a lazy, a weaker, insipid sort of a church. That's what comfort brings. And sometimes we need a crisis to open our eyes to our weakness, and then we maybe do something about our weakness. I remember seeing a movie on the TV. It was investigating the comet. Remember the comet? One of the early jet liners. And they kept on falling out of the sky. Then they went to find out why this thing was failing. And after meticulous experimenting and investigation, they found the problem and corrected it. And so turned it from something that was a disaster into something that's been very successful ever since. You see, the failures, if you deal with them, good can come out of it, and in the end, you can get a better quality of safety or travel or whatever it happens to be. It seems to me the same sort of thing happens in our faith. We drift along without any real tests, without anything going wrong, without being upset, without being tilted, and we just settle down, and we're not really sure if our faith is as good as we think it is. We think it's okay, but it's not tested. It seems to me that the only genuine faith is that which serves in the day of trial. We think that we should be exempt from trials, that we should be able to get along with our cozy lifestyle. And as a result, our faith sometimes is not as good as we thought. And then when the testing time comes, sometimes we find that we weren't quite the quality Christians that we imagined ourselves to be. And so we settle on our lees. The good wine is spoiled, and God maybe has to send something along to disturb us, to tip us on our head. We have no right to this lifestyle that we enjoy here. We have a good lifestyle. I'd much rather live in a country like this than live in Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Libya or Somalia or some place like that. But the problem is, we think that we now have a right to this, and God is obligated to preserve it for us. Well, God is not obligated to preserve it for us. And when I look at the New Testament and the life that Jesus told his disciples about, it seems to me that the sort of life that we're taking for granted in our country doesn't bear very much resemblance to the sort of life that Jesus was talking about of his disciples. We've got to take action with ourselves, because there's nothing in our society that's going to make us change it. In fact, everything in our society is going to go the opposite way and tell us we deserve more, and the government's going to do more for us because it wants us to vote them back next election. And everybody else is going to give us all of these wonderful things. The whole drift is to say how much better they're going to make things for us, when Jesus is talking about something different, saying how much we ought to be denying ourselves for the sake of others. But unfortunately, we've got ourselves into this mentality that if, for example, there was an invasion of Australia by some unfriendly nation round about, we would think that God would defend us. He's obligated to defend us because we're respectable, cleaned up, middle class, Anglo-Saxon Christians, and we're a Christian country. Who said? He didn't defend the Israelites. They thought he was going to save them from the Babylonians, but he didn't. The Babylonians came in and wiped them out. The Israelites thought that was the Judeans rather, the Israelites thought they would be saved when the Assyrians attacked, but the Assyrians wiped them out too. Then the Babylonians came on and wiped out the Judeans. A contemporary of Jeremiah is a man called Zephaniah. Zephaniah, in fact, came before Jeremiah. He was the one that started this revival of spiritual awareness after a long period of deadness. And he said the same sort of things. Zephaniah, probably a little bit older than Jeremiah. We only have a short book from him. Jeremiah, of course, was around for 40 years, and we have a lot from him. But Zephaniah says much the same thing. I'll just read it to you. God says, I'm going to attack Jerusalem again with the Babylonians. I'm going to search Jerusalem with lamps, and I'm going to punish the men who are thickening upon their lees, who say in their hearts, the Lord will not do good, nor will he do ill. Your goods shall be plundered, your houses shall be laid waste. And even if you build houses, you won't inhabit them. And if you plant vineyards, you won't drink the wine from them, because I'm going to destroy the lot. But it's the same message that Zephaniah was giving to Israel as Jeremiah here is giving to these people of Moab. Jesus said the same to the church in Laodicea. You're neither hot nor cold. You think you've got everything, but actually you're miserable and poor and blind and naked, and you make me sick. That's what he said. You make me sick. I'm going to spew you out of my mouth. To that church in Laodicea, which bears some similarity to much of the Western world today. But here we are sitting here thinking we deserve not to be disturbed. And one wonders at times, I'm not a prophet of the predicting kind, suggesting what God might do, but it's hardly surprising when things are sent to disturb us. There's nothing wrong with aiming for peace and prosperity. It's a perfectly legitimate and noble aim for a society to have. We aim for peace and prosperity, but what we get is peace and selfishness. That's what we get, peace and self-indulgence. We want to progress, which is fair enough, but what we get instead of just progress is a lot of waste and damage, exploitation. We want security so that we can dwell in safety, fair enough, but what happens is we become complacent and more slack in our moral standards. We want a better life. We finish up with death, and so it goes on. Now this can apply to us individually, it can apply to a nation, you can take it across the board, whether it's ancient Israel or nations such as Moab and Edom and Ammon and others, whether it's nations today. Jeremiah, of course, applied it nationally. I've got no idea what's going to happen to Australia, but I don't deceive myself that we are entitled to the preservation of our current existence indefinitely. Especially when you see the nation has thumbed its nose at God and forsaken just about every commandment and instruction that he gave, we certainly are not entitled to ongoing blessings in perpetuity. And what about the church? Doesn't matter where you go. It's the same problem that the atmosphere of the world has affected the church. The church seems to have the same sort of disease that most of the society has. Now, there are other countries that had glorious pasts, and they finished up on the ash heap. People thought in Israel and Judah that God was on their side, because after all they were his people, and these Babylonians and Assyrians, they were pagans, but God allowed them to do their stuff. Old Testament times, even in New Testament times, they thought the Messiah was going to deliver them now and restore the kingdom to Israel. And it wasn't going to be that way. Jesus said, no, it's not going to be the way you think. This is not the entrance into the golden era for the nation Israel. In fact, this temple here, there won't be one stone left upon another. It'll be destroyed. The Romans are going to come in, and they did, and they came and they wiped out Jerusalem in AD 70. Even in the modern world, we can think of examples of countries that used to be Christian, and look at the mess they're in. You can look at places in North Africa like Tunisia and Libya in the early Christian days in the first century. They were and the second century and third century, they were some of the strongholds of early Christianity, those countries of North Africa. Almost 100% Islamic now. You can go back, not many years, 100 years or so, and find that Turkey was largely Christian. So many Christians there, so many churches, and look at it now. You can look at Russia, that once used to be a bastion of Christian faith, and then, of course, it got trampled all over by communism. And so we could go on. These countries have been tipped well and truly on their heads. But in the Western world, which we still call Christian, we haven't sort of been tipped on our head in the same way. But in the meantime, what has happened in the rest of the world is that these other countries, the tough places of Africa and Asia, Latin America, here the church is robust and vibrant. In the midst of hardship, it has grown and developed. While the rest of us, we become more effete, more wishy-washy, and just about on our last legs, it seems. The thing is that many Christians in the West are unaware of these things. They're unaware of their own spiritual problems, but they're also unaware of the virility that there is in the church in other countries. We're living in the day of greatest church growth since apostolic times. The church has grown more in the last 25 years than any period in the history of the church. And yet most people in the West seem to be unaware of it, because we live in this cocoon that we have here, and we get further and further behind. We're outnumbered. We don't even number 25% now of the Christians in the whole world, whereas 50 years ago we might have numbered 75%. But now 75% of the Christians are in these other parts of the world, and here are we sort of going downhill all the time. And sometimes, as I say, you tell people these things and they don't believe you. You tell them about some of the progress that's seen, some of the developments taking place, what God is doing in some of these countries of Africa and Asia and other parts of the world. And they say, oh yes, and just move on their way. It doesn't really sink in. There is still this notion that somehow the West leads the world. Well, we certainly don't lead the world in Christianity any longer. We, like Moab, have settled on our lees. We haven't been tilted, but who knows, God might send along some tilters one day and tilt us so that we wake up to ourselves. I just jotted down here to spice this up a little bit with some examples of what's happening in a few places around the world. I could talk about China, of course. Everybody knows what has happened in China. Well, I hope they know what's happened in China. Unheard of in the history of the human race. There's never been such growth as there has been in China in the last 50 years. Nobody knows the number, 60 million, 100 million or something of evangelical Christians. It's been the greatest miracle, certainly in the history of the church. I read a report recently that said there is a Christian fellowship in almost every college and university in China. Even though the religion of Christianity is still outlawed, still illegal unless you toe the party line, but most of what I talk about here, the evangelical Christians are not part of the establishment church. Cuba. We know what Fidel Castro did to Cuba and how they were suppressed for so long there. Here was a report I read just recently. 2,000 conversions just recently in a few months. 80% of these people, youths under the age of 25. And you'll get other reports coming out of Cuba. What's happening in there? There's quite a revolution taking place in evangelical circles. And a great lack of pastors, a lack of teachers, a lack of people who can train and disciple and build churches out of these people that are coming to Christ. God is doing amazing things. I'm sorry I can't say that every one of the communist countries or former communist countries has that sort of growth. You look at North Korea and it's an absolute disaster for the church. The number of Christians nobody knows, you can count them on your fingers perhaps. And then you've got Laos and Vietnam, which are still among the most oppressed countries in the world because of the communist regimes there that still stamp all over them. And so it's not just a picture of unbroken triumph. There are still places of terrible, terrible suffering. But even in those countries, there is emerging a strong church. Cambodia, for example. You all know that only a couple of decades ago, you could hardly put your finger on a Christian anywhere in Cambodia. And after Pol Pot had finished with the place, you could hardly count anybody else either. And now we have a virile church in Cambodia, which is really the most rapidly growing church in the whole of Southeast Asia. I read this just last week. In recent months, 108 new churches have been planted by one particular ministry. These are not missionaries, these are local Christians out doing it. Here's another ministry started in Phnom Penh, training people to go out in church planting. 64 churches they planted in the last 3 months. Some of these figures you may have to water down a little bit, but even if you cut it in half, planting 32 churches in 3 months is not bad, is it? And if you get 54 churches planted in last year, that's not bad either. The Quechuas of South America, here's another one for you. In 1967, there were 120 believers in a population of 3 million. Today, at least 45%, probably near to 50% of the Quechuas in South America are evangelical, Bible-believing Christians. Just an amazing work that back in the 60s nobody would ever have imagined could have happened. Nigeria, which is one place that I have a lot to do with, there's an organization there called NEMA, N-E-M-A, the Nigerian Evangelical Missions Association. It's an entirely local thing. They have 60 missions that are members, and they have over 3,000 missionaries working among the unreached tribal groups of Nigeria and in neighboring countries. You know the work that I'm tied up with Bridgeway, sending books and Bible study materials to some of these countries. We're sending to Nigerian missionaries, I think, in 11 African countries. They are far ahead of us when it comes to vision, reaching out to the unreached in mission. Zimbabwe, which is another one of the countries we have a lot to do with. Back in 1992, the evangelical churches, they got together and they set a goal to plant 10,000 churches in the next 10 years. And Zimbabwe is not nearly as big as Australia in population, so going for a goal of 10,000 churches in 10 years is reasonably ambitious. At the beginning of this year, they passed the 10,000 inside their 10 years. It is just amazing what is happening in some of these countries. But if you look at those countries, all of those that I've mentioned have been through tremendous trials. Zimbabwe is a case that's going through absolutely frightful trial at present. It is just falling apart. It is, instead of the best of the African countries that I visited 10 years ago, it's now probably one of the worst. It's almost non-functioning. The economy is gone and 75% of the people are out of work. You get other bits and pieces on the radio and TV news. But in the midst of all of this chaos and hardship, a vigorous church is coming forth. You've probably heard about the famine that is across a lot of Zimbabwe and Zambia and Malawi. But in Zambia and Malawi, likewise, this enormous virility in the church. All of these places, they haven't had a chance to settle on their lees. And so they haven't gone sour. They have been tipped out. And so the liquid has become more and more pure. And now we have a church which is bringing, I'm sure, much pleasure to the heart of God. And it's bringing such growth to the worldwide picture of Christianity. We hear about some countries and their needs, and our first impulse as Westerners is, let's send in a team. No. If we send in a team, there's a fair chance that in the majority of cases, all we'll do is spread the disease of Westernism. It's being spread bad enough now. It's being spread through the media. Anything that starts in America finishes up in Britain and Australia and New Zealand and eventually finishes up in these other countries. And you know how it's coming in? It's coming in through the televangelists. Yeah, these televangelists from America, they're two a penny. I read a report recently that said there are 350 Christian TV stations in America. Well, you can imagine the stuff they turn out on this quick fix Christianity. It's cheap as dirt. And I go to Zambia or Malawi, I see people watching TV and I see this absolute rubbish that's coming from America, and it's coming across all this prosperity doctrine. Isn't God wonderful? He'll give you all this money. And this corrupt Western mentality is being fed through all sorts of ways. And sad to say, one of them is through these quasi-Christian activities. No, the answer is not to send in a team. There are some people, of course, who could do a lot of good in some of these countries. But what they need probably is resources, materials, equipment. They've got the enthusiasm. You don't have to go around belting people over a head to be evangelists in these countries. They are queued up wanting to be evangelists. Sometimes more enthusiasm than maturity. And so we have to somehow give them the sorts of materials that are going to help them do their job better. Well, that's my bit for this morning. But just coming back to ourselves to finish with, We, in our own Christian lives, in our churches and in our country in general, we certainly have got to the stage where I think we've got to start taking stock of things, because we've drifted along through a couple of generations now, and I don't think we've realized the state we've got ourselves into. As I say, I'm not going to make any predictions, but I read these verses again, and I could just drop the word Australia in here and say, well, Australia's been at ease from its youth, and now it's become settled on its lees. Hasn't gone into exile, but its taste has gone sour. Its scent, not so good. So the days are coming, says the Lord, and I'm going to do something to you. I'm going to send tilters who are going to tilt you and empty your vessels and break you in pieces, and then you shall be ashamed of the God of Mammon, or whatever other God you want to think of, because that God will not save in the day of testing. May the Lord use that to encourage and challenge each of us as we need it, to see ourselves and to see the bigger picture of the church around the world, to make sure that we are part of this sort of church that God wants us to be, and to pray for our brothers and sisters and help them in whatever way we can.